Thanks very much, Ken. And like the Foreign Minister, I'm in the camp of the glass half full. Sorry
about
that.
I knew
you
would be.
Really, the central issue for this session is really where is future growth in the global and Australian economy going to come from? And there are four points that I want to make. The first is that for a while, growth can come from a cyclical pickup in the global economy. Over 2017, the global economy actually has improved quite a lot. And it's not just a story in one or two countries, it's fairly broad-based. After nearly a decade, the healing process from the financial crisis is now pretty well advanced, although there's still scar tissue around. The Chinese economies continue to grow at a reasonable rate, and in Europe it's been quite a few years now since the underlying tensions last erupted. Globally, monetary policy is very supportive. There's been a lot of financial system repair, and fiscal policy is no longer contractionary in most countries. This is all helping. So we're in a better position than we have been for some time. Be clear, we're not talking about a boom, and there are still plenty of risks out there, but globally things are quite a lot better than they have been for a while. Animal spirits around the world have been missing for quite some time, and it might just be that they're starting to come back. The second point is that at some point the cyclical upswing will run its course. And beyond that, much depends upon demographics and technology. And here I find reasons for both pessimism and optimism. Many developed countries, as well as in China and Korea, face very significant demographic challenges. Their populations are stagnant or they're declining. They're also aging. And older societies tend to want to save, not invest, especially when there'll be fewer people tomorrow than there are today. And older societies are more likely to be risk-averse. So I think this is a major issue. On technology, I'm more optimistic. As the Foreign Minister spoke about, there are great advances being made in the sciences, in the material sciences, in power generation and storage, in genetics and health sciences, and in computing and artificial intelligence. It's hard to know how all these advances are ultimately going to play out. But they do open up possibilities that few of us have trouble imagining. They can transform our societies and open up a wave of new global investment and ultimately higher living standards. We can't be sure how things will play out, time will tell, but a very clear lesson from history is that advances in technology form the backbone of higher living standards. As the Foreign Minister said, an obvious question is, how do we create and seize the opportunities that technology offers? And there'll be those in the audience who are better placed to answer that question than me. I do, though, find it hard to escape the conclusion that the starting point must be very heavy investment in human capital and the creation of a culture that promotes innovation. A related challenge we face is the distributional effects of technological progress. The sheer scale of global markets means that the potential gains to innovation to those who can take advantage of that are huge. At the same time, new technologies and globalisation creates losers. And at the moment, our societies are struggling with how to deal with that tension. We all have a really strong interest in working out a better way of dealing with this tension. If we don't do this, technological progress and globalisation could come to be seen as bad things, not the good things they really are, and this would surely harm prospects for long-run growth. My third point is that in Australia, it's likely that growth over the next couple of years will be a bit stronger than it's been recently. The pickup in the global economy is helping us. The return of mining investment to more normal levels is almost complete. Monetary policy continues to be supportive of growth, and survey-based measures of business confidence are quite a high level. And employment growth has improved quite a lot over recent months, and these are all positive developments. We do, though, face some headwinds. Households are gradually coming to grips with slower growth in their real incomes. Growth in wages is unusually low, average hours worked are in decline, and the nature of employment is changing. So for many households, there's a recalibration of expectations going on. Many households are also coming to grips with higher debt levels, and in our larger cities with higher housing prices relative to our incomes. And these are issues that we're watching very carefully. The fourth and final point I'd like to make is that Australia's longer-term prospects remain positive, but we need to keep working to keep them that way. Over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of public discussion about Australia's record run of 26 years without a technical recession. This is a significant achievement. We've done better than most other countries over a long period of time. But just in case we're inclined to celebrate too much, we should remember that over those 26 years, there have been three episodes of rising unemployment, and we should also remember that strong population growth in Australia has flattered our headline growth figures. As things currently stand, it looks likely that average growth in per capita incomes over the next quarter of a century will be lower than it was over the past quarter of a century. We should, though, be capable of stronger growth than we've seen over the past few years. We can't take this for granted. It's vitally important that we keep a sharp focus on reforms that can make a real difference to our living standards, and if we don't, we will fall behind. The positive news is that there is no shortage of good ideas here to pursue. The not-so-positive news is that there is a shortage of good ideas that can successfully navigate the political process, and this is something we need to work on. As we search for the reforms that will make a difference, we need to be aware that the drivers of growth in our economy are changing. Natural resources remain the main source of exports, but Australians are increasingly employed in service industries. And right across the spectrum, no matter what industry you're talking about, competitive advantage is increasingly built upon technology and upon management capability. That trend isn't going to go away, and it's something we need to capitalise on. There's no magic solution, but as I said before, the central ingredient must lie in investment in human capital. If we are to grow strongly in the future, then that growth will be built just as much on the quality of our ideas as it is on the quality of our natural resources. That's my glass half full. Thanks, Ken.
Renee Leon, Secretary of the Employment Department. So you'll be pleased to know there's reasons for optimism, but not in a complacent way. And I don't think we can afford to just do nothing and assume that it will work out. But I think it is worth pointing out that we already have had the internet for a number of decades, and we've already had decades of automation, and our experience in the labour market and in the economy in Australia is that we have created many more jobs than we have destroyed. And if you think about some of the areas we're all very familiar with by way of automation, we've done that in ways that have created more and better services and added to the ease and convenience of all of our lives. So we all remember what it was like that you couldn't go to the bank unless you got there before 4:30 on a Friday because you had to get money from the teller. Tellers are almost non-existent now. 17,000 tellers, I think, went out of business as a result of automation to ATMs. Banks employ nearly double that number of financial service providers and advisors now, so the jobs have changed, but they haven't disappeared. What we have to do, and there's multiple examples of that across industries, but what we do have to do, and what governments across, you know, state and Commonwealth are doing, is consciously prepare for that, the change that's on foot, and which, as everyone has said, is happening at a faster and faster rate. So although national curriculum's kind of an unsexy topic, in fact the states and territories have agreed to national curriculum changes that put much more focus on soft skills that will be transferable to multiple jobs of the future around teamwork and collaboration and creativity and so on, against the tide of kind of parental desire for getting back to more concrete things that'll definitely get you a job, when we know that the most of the content we teach now will probably be irrelevant by the time the people who are in school now are entering the workforce. So being able to paint the picture of what's required in order to help people transition is something that I think we all need to be part of a national conversation about. And being prepared to invest in what is sometimes seen as kind of wasteful program spending instead on those most at risk of being left behind. So it's not possible for those who used to be manufacturing workers to just up and become social media consultants, but we do need to invest in what are the realistic transitions for people whose jobs in manufacturing or mining or other blue-collar trades are disappearing, and how we can skill them up to be the digitally enhanced workers, not of the future, but of actually the present and the very near future.
Yeah. Okay. Just quickly, while the microphone passes to the to the next. You know that story about the banks, and it's true, it's moved on apace. So the number of ATMs is now falling.
Can I make an observation, not about the banks?
You're very welcome to make an observation about the banks.
Everyone
in public.
Else is.
It's really about the labour market. We've got there's this story, there's this crisis in the labour market that the unemployment rate in the US, in Germany, in the UK, in Japan, lowest in many decades.
Yeah.
So the big four Western economies have the lowest unemployment rate. And if you kind of just listen to this idea that there's a crisis in the labour market, you wouldn't have thought that. The crisis really is in real wage growth. So the jobs generation process in the big economies, including in Australia, is working kind of okay. But Western workers feel like they can't get pay rises.
So we'll go here, and then I want to come back to you and ask you to reflect on that. How much of that's due to low productivity and what can be done about that?
Thank you. Rob Fitzpatrick. I'm the CEO of the Australian Information Industry Association. I guess it's part of my job to be rapidly optimistic, possibly the opposite of you, John. I don't believe there is such a thing as a glass half full or half empty. Glasses are full. It's just, what are they full with? They are full with water and air.
We're going to continue all the way through the day.
I'd like to start, though, by reading a quote from Time magazine, if you don't mind. And the Time magazine pointed out that automation may prevent the economy from creating enough new jobs. It went on to say, automation is beginning to move in and eliminate service and jobs too. The quote was from 1961. And jobs have grown since then. They have not stagnated and fallen. Ever since Ned Ludd in 1811, 206 years ago, tried to bash the machines and say the future is not going to work for us, we've had the Luddites. We have had those who are fearful, and there is reason to be fearful. Technology is taking away jobs today, but technology is also creating jobs for the future. There are new industries emerging, and the extent to which we can support those and see those, the Foreign Minister talked about the connected vehicle market. The US is now calling that a $200 billion industry that did not exist 5 years ago. It's a significant driver of the economy. The whole cybersecurity sector is a jobs growth sector. There are enormous opportunities, and while digital inclusion is a factor for all of us to consider and take seriously, you hear anecdotes of homeless in Sydney, 80% of whom have smartphones, and they contact each other to talk about where the best meal is at which food truck at night. So they all then descend on us. Now, we are here for these 2 days to talk about policy and government policy, but governments around the world are also representing at least one third of the tech spend in each economy. So governments and the extent to which we in industry can work with governments to accelerate real practical examples where governments could be exemplars of great technology spend, that's part of the future solution.
Okay. If there are any Luddites in the room, I'm not going to pass the microphone to you, or at least not knowingly. It's good. Sorry, is there some... Oh, yes. John.
The reason why it looks as though there's not a crisis in the labour market is the way unemployment's measured, of course. That is, 1 hour of work a week is defined by the ILO and most Western countries as employment, and it's not. And in Australia, the underutilisation of labour is about 15% of the workforce, and it's something like that in the US as well. That isn't the principle thing I wanted to draw attention to. Digitalisation's great in many ways, but one of the costs of it is the enormity of the international tax evasion that happens as a result of it. And that requires action at the national level and also at the global level because of the kinds of agreements that have to be made in order to get greater transparency between countries. I'd be delighted if Helen felt able to make a comment on the importance of getting improved international cooperation in order to clamp down on international tax evasion, as well, of course, as making national tax systems somewhat more progressive so as to generate the revenue for the education that's necessary to get more people into employment.
Okay, we've got a few issues to discuss now. So, Helen, I'll go to you first, and then I want to ask Phil a couple of questions.
I think some great work's been done through the G20 and through OECD on the international tax evasion issues. Some of the concern, though, comes from countries that aren't in OECD or aren't in G20, which is most, who say they need more inclusive forums to tackle these things. And this was a huge issue at the third International Financing for Development Conference in Addis Ababa a couple of years ago, where there was an attempt to try and move the forum for tackling these things to the UN, and the OECD countries and G20 absolutely resisted that because they had their own thing going. But I don't want in any sense to detract from the importance of that work. With OECD, UNDP in my time formed a partnership around what we call Tax Inspectors Without Borders. And through that, and with donor support, we've together been putting tax audit experts into work alongside developing country departments to help them face it down international companies to ensure they pay the tax they should be paying in that country. And I know if Angel Gurria were here from OECD, he would be talking about how the whole nature of the conversation changes in the developing country capital when the international company is confronted with international experts that actually know what they're talking about and know what they should be going after. So this is starting to release some quite useful revenue for developing country treasuries. And again, takes me back to my point I'll keep banging on about, which is the catalytic impact of overseas development assistance in funding these sort of things to build and transfer capacities to get in the money you should be getting, grow your economies, create the enabling environment, and so on.
Mm. I might ask Pascal to add to those remarks.
No, I totally agree that there has been a big change thanks to the 08 crisis. I mean, I was a Sherpa in the G7 Sherpa in the 90s, and I became a member of the G20 when I was DG of WTO, and it's night and day. In the 90s, this problem of what diplomats call excessive tax optimization, which is a very nice way of putting it, diplomats are always there to put things nicely, was on the table. But systematically, UK and US refused to do anything in the G7. By the way, it was exactly the same on financial regulation at the time, remember. 08 crisis totally changed this. Suddenly, US and UK totally changed their position, and this opened the road for the OECD, who has a very strong tax department. It's one example of having a bulk of solid expertise somewhere in the system, although it's been underused for many years. The moment there is an opportunity, a window, zoom. And that has changed. I mean, the base erosion and profit shifting, which now the G20 is pursuing, I think is a very positive development, both for technical reasons, but also obviously for political reasons, because this notion that, you know, multinationals optimize so that, you know, they put their profits where there is no tax and they put their losses where there is tax is something that is politically totally unsustainable. So I think this is a positive. Of course, it has to be followed up, and it's full of complex detail on how do you calculate value addition in, you know, and how do you manipulate royalties. And but it's a positive development, and it's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. David Groom.
I wanted to draw attention to a puzzle, at least it's a puzzle for me. There's been a lot of discussion here, and you hear it very often, about just how unprecedented the pace of technological change is at the moment and all the disruptive things that it's generating on communities and labour markets. But at the same time as we're seeing what is said to be unprecedented pace of technological change, we've also got right across the developed world almost the most sluggish productivity growth that we've seen in a very long time. Yeah. So it appears that all this technological change is generating social effects to do with disrupting the way people live their lives and work in the labour market, and that's having obvious spillovers to the political process, whether you're talking about the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe, various other places. But if that's true, and if it's doing, if it's generating this sort of change in how the factors of production are being employed, it is passing strange that it's not generating productivity growth and therefore rising living standards. That is a very strange set of circumstances.
Well, it might be generating rising living standards, it's just not measured in productivity. That's possible, isn't it?
It's possible.
It's possible. It's there's a measurement issue. There's also the question of, even if it was being measured as a productivity boost, would it be the sort of productivity boost that translates into strong growth in government revenues, i.e. in tax bases? You see, on the tax question, there's two issues. Sure. The first is whether the tax is going to be collected globally, but the second is whether we're in a growth cycle that is generating sufficient revenue for governments to be able to deliver the government services that they're committed to delivering.
There's no question that that's also an issue, but to the extent that it can be measured, it appears that productivity growth is pretty sluggish.
Yeah, sure.
And those people who've looked at the mismeasurement issue acknowledge it, but say, we've always had difficult measurement issues in productivity growth.
Sure.
And at least as I read the consensus, the mismeasurement issues don't explain the slowdown.
Okay. Phil, I am going to come back to you before you leave the room, but Warwick, can we go to you first? And then there's one up, oh my God, all right, here, I'm going to see it. All right. And I want to do my best to let you all have a chance. Yes, Warwick.
Yes, I just wanted to raise an issue that hasn't been touched on yet, which I'm very surprised about when you're talking about the state of the world economy, and that's the difference between stocks and flows. All the discussion so far, the Ken's data was all about the flow of income, the flow of the current account. My concern right now is we're in a world economy where the Fed is starting to raise interest rates and we have an enormous amount of household debt in some economies like ours, government debt, and Pascal raised the Chinese issue. I'd be less worried about China with a growth rate of 6% and 200% debt to GDP than most of Europe, which has debt to GDP ratios in excess of 150% of GDP. So it seems to me that what we've done during this last decade, instead of deal with the fundamental problems, we've borrowed to try and bring forward from future generations consumption for the present generation. That is not sustainable, and that to me means that the next 5 to 10 years is a very critical turning point in the world economy once those imbalances have to be addressed.
Yeah, and an issue for Australia as well, right? So back in 1983, Australia's net public debt to GDP ratio was 9.3. At the time, that was considered unsustainable. That was our view. Our view was we had to do something about that. And we did. And by 1989-90, it had fallen from 9.3% of GDP to 4% of GDP. And then, as you know, over the subsequent decade, it fell negative. We actually got it down, negative net public sector debt. And today it's up at about 17% of GDP with, at least in my view, little likelihood of falling much below that for a very long period of time. So for Australia, there's a stocks issue. Now, maybe we were just too worried about something we shouldn't have been so worried about. Maybe we should have been sanguine in the 80s instead of being sanguine in the last 15 years or so. But I'm actually not sure about that. One right up the back. That hand went... Yes, right up the back. That hand went up first. Yep.
Hi, Catherine Wall. Does this work? Yeah, Catherine Walby. I'm the director of the Research School of Social Sciences here at the ANU. So it seems to me one of the dynamics that's preventing better distribution of benefits of innovation is the rise of the gig economy. We have seen that it is part of the business model of companies like Uber and Airtasker to constitute the kind of work that they enable by removing the social protections and the equity effects that we associate historically with the labour contract. So people don't have superannuation, they don't have health insurance, they don't have those kinds of provision. And it strikes me that that this points to the necessity for something like the European Union's responsible research and innovation policy here. It's an element in the Horizon 2020 research investment process in Europe that any kind of innovation which is funded through that process and through the European Research Council, that it has a responsible research and innovation test. And this is not a widely known policy in Australia, at least in my experience. And it just strikes me that there's considerable policy learning that we could pursue along these kinds of lines.
Okay.
Can I just comment on that? Because yes, it actually does flip back, if I could, to one of the discussions on the impact of this algorithmic revolution and the way in which it's playing out in terms of the business models. Because what you're actually identifying there is actually a discussion we haven't really had, is what are the business models that are actually surrounding this kind of disruption and algorithmic revolution? And it's driven very much, if you look at it coming out of the Silicon Valley, by change in thinking. And there are Silicon Valleyites here, and no doubt they'll have a different view. But if you look at it, the view, say, of a Packard and a Hewlett in the commencement period of the Silicon Valley was one about the kind of responsibilities we talked about now. There's actually quite a different mindset at the moment operating, which is actually much more around libertarianism. I think you might see that coming out a lot of the statements. But the interesting thing there, if you actually think about the true disruption coming out of this algorithmic revolution through the business model, is that a lot of these companies are actually not very profitable. But what they do is they actually create a lot of wealth. If you look at Amazon, for example, Amazon is much less profitable on an annual basis than its major, well, the people, the organization is trying to disrupt most aggressively, which is Walmart. But its market cap is four times as high. If you think about what's being sought here by the venture capitalists who support this, which is actually not an unattractive, I mean, I'm a capitalist, we don't think about it much here because the venture capital market is so insignificant. Apologies to those who participate in it, but in the US, I mean, you're talking about a $250-350 billion play here. Their sole aim is to actually identify at the moment aspects of work which is capable of automation, which an algorithm can be applied to for multiple scaling, and on the basis of that, then acquisition, etc., and ultimately disposal. So it's quite a different business model that's operating and quite a different mentality that's operating. And actually, it's quite interesting to start seeing some governance come into some of these, like the Ubers, etc., and some of the other companies where there's been a grappling, I think, with the governance of these entities. And you would have seen the kind of turnover in executive ranks at Uber most recently. And a lot of that kind of libertarian thinking, I think, is now moving into the grounds where it's just not acceptable. And it goes to the issue of tax. They actually do have to pay tax somewhere. And my point on these technology companies is that if we take a view that they are disrupting employment opportunities for others, well, that's okay, and we know that's going to happen. But there has to be some responsibility. There has to be some responsibility, and how do we give effect to that? I don't know whether it's through European policy, but I do think it's part of the conversation we should be having.
Yeah, okay. Pascal?
That goes back to the point we already discussed yesterday night, which is this notion that welfare systems were created in the first place to cope with these disruptions. And what we've seen in recent times is that disruptions have gotten stronger and welfare systems have gotten weaker. And this is my own explanation, by the way, and again, referring to what we discussed yesterday night, to this difference in where populism is stronger, is where this difference is the largest, and where populism can be sort of contained is where this difference it has maintained lower. And that's, I think, something. It doesn't say that we have to keep welfare systems the way we used to run them. There's a huge challenge on how to change welfare system in order to cope with the new kinds of violence and disruptions. But that's a big thing we should do. And I think in this, I mean, I've always seen Australia as a sort of European-like country, like New Zealand, like Canada, by the way. I mean, ideologically, I think, I hope I'm not offending anybody in saying, from where I am, you're in the same mold. And that's a common challenge for a country like this and for European countries.
Sure. Phil, there's in your opening remarks, you referred to anemic growth in household income, and there's been quite a bit of commentary this morning about factors that may or may not be contributing to that, the casualisation of the workforce that I think John Langmore was referring to. Average hours of work have fallen by 4% in Australia over the past decade, and it does seem to me, I could be wrong, but it seems to me to be a structural shift. There's a strong trend there anyway. And then there's this question about productivity and whether and the extent to which productivity is feeding through into household income. Do you have reflections on these? Can you unpack your comment about anemic household income growth?
I'll try to. On the hour, the decline in the hours of work, some people look at that and say this is kind of terrible. I actually can see an upside of that because this distinction between part-time and full-time employment is old-fashioned. So there are a lot of people who actually work part-time who want to work part-time. In fact, the vast bulk of those people actually want to work part-time. They'd like to work a few more hours, but you know, the fact that we're working a few less hours on average is probably a good thing, not a bad thing, and not a sign of weakness. But the problem, and this is not unique to Australia, is weak wages growth, and that's making everyone, or workers, unhappy. So why is this happening? One, productivity growth is slow, despite all the technology progress that David talks about. I think it's temporarily slow because productivity growth tends to come in waves, and in the optimistic interpretation, we'll see another wave sometime, not too far down the track. So, a second factor is that workers feel like there are more competitors out there. That they worry about the foreigners and the robots. And when any of us feel like there's more competition there...
Are the robots foreigners?
Well, they can be. They can be domestic robots. They worry about the foreign competition and they worry about the robots. And you know, when anyone feels like there's more competition, you're less inclined to put your price up. The firms act like that and workers act like that. And the third thing that's going on in this uncertain world that kind of we keep on hearing about in this room... people value security, and one way to get a bit more security is not to demand a bigger wage rise. So we value employment security in an uncertain world, and so we're less inclined to put our price up. So Western workers value security, worried about more competitors, and productivity growth is slow, so real wage growth is low and the labour share of national income is in decline. So I don't think any of these things are going to change quickly, so we're going to have to get used to it, unfortunately. Some things we can do, though. The labour market's actually quite tight in a number of countries. And as I said before, the unemployment rate in the four big Western countries is the lowest in four decades. At some point, one imagines that's going to lead to workers being prepared to ask for larger wage rises. And if that were to happen, that would be a good thing. If we can put the pressure on the labour market, that might energise workers to kind of overcome these fears of competition and uncertainty. Another thing we can work through is kind of in the tax and transfer system, and a couple of people have touched on that as well. But in the end, I don't think that's the solution here. It's really in the third element that I would focus on is that is a kind of education. These problems we're talking about aren't going to be solved in 1 year or 2 years. They're going to be solved in a decade, maybe, if we're lucky. So in a decade, you can really make a difference to the way we do human capital accumulation. Since we that... needs to be the focus, rather than kind of bemoaning about technology all the time and its effect. I mean, does anyone think here we can make ourselves wealthier by not having improvements in technology or actually going backwards on technology? It's kind of fanciful, really. So technology, that's the basis of improving our living standards. So we've got to work out how to do that, how to survive in that. And I think that's the education system and at the margin, the tax and transfer system. And hopefully running for a few years now with quite tight labour markets, re-energising workers and trying to get the labour share of national income in many countries up. That'll make us all feel a bit better.
Yeah, OK. And I'd be surprised if there's anybody in the room who wouldn't share that perspective, at least at an aspirational level. Yep.
So Ken Baldwin, Director of the ANU Energy Change Institute. I'd like to return to this idea of technological change and the ability to predict it. And what we're hearing is that government and governance is constantly being surprised by technological change. a good example is the Finkel review into the national electricity market, which was, you know, a result of the fact that our governance systems haven't moved to keep pace with the rapid technological change in the energy sector. So, given that you know, there's been a declining capability in the public service over many decades to have the capacity to look forward with real expertise as to what's happening in technological change, is there a role for universities, and you know, the Crawford Forum is just maybe a microcosmic example of this, to have a new compact with government so that we constantly innovate our government and our governance structures with expert advice as to where things are really heading in the technological space?
Challenging question. Mm-hmm. Whilst people are reflecting on that, and I will come to you, could we have the microphone down here for Gordon, please, and then I'll come to you, John. Yeah. Please reflect on that rather challenging question.
Actually, could I make a short answer? Actually, the Finkel report, I mean, one of the great things about Australia is how we're able to reduce complex policy issues to either numbers, acronyms, or surnames. So it's either we're talking about 457s, Section 18, or the NDIS, or EBAs, or FTAs, and then it's Gonski, Finkel, and actually Henry. So I don't know whether universities help in that regard or not, but I would refer... There's a very interesting speech that Grant King gave to the press club here, and he talked about experts and energy. And if you go back to the very issue that Alan's looking into, where that policy came from, that RETS was actually supposed to be about the increases, the percentages of the increases in energy, electricity. What actually happened was they didn't come out as it was, and it got suppressed into base load, and then you've got this problem. But perhaps if industry experts had been listened to, it might have been helpful before the whole thing got carried away into another acronym, which is RET. But, you know, this is a real issue. And I do think, and I will say this, I'm not on the board of the Business Council, though I've been an active participant. The Business Council of Australia is making some very sensible and very helpful observations about how we can address this issue around policy formation and certainty of policy. Because the other observation I'd make is that uncertainty in policy formation does have a cost. You know, there is actually a velocity index that looks at this. And at the moment, on a global basis, we're operating at 1.5 times that standard, outside standard variation. Now, that's kind of interesting, its number, but the Bank of England looked at this specifically. That actually has had a 7% impact on investment. And they would say over a 3-year period, that actually has a 1% hit on GDP. All I'm saying out there is that we can talk about policy uncertainty as though it's abstract, but the way this is being analysed through those lenses, it actually does have a cost. So policy formation and certainty and bringing business, legitimising business back into helping shaping those outcomes, I think is an essential element of enabling prosperity to be reignited here, because private sector has a legitimate voice and interest in these issues.
Mm. So, Gordon, just I do want to make a two-handed intervention myself here. So I agree very much with
about
the idea.
About the initials or the what?
No, I agree very much with Ken, with the thought behind Ken's question, which is, you know, to have the innovation getting into government and in the way the government thinks about issues. And also, I agree with you that there's a strong role, a role hasn't been played as well as it might have historically, but anyway, the future's the future. There's a future opportunity for Australian business to get more involved. But, you know, in this particular area, I look back on it and I ask myself this question. Is there anything that we've seen in the disruption of the Australian electricity market that was not within the scope of the scenarios that officials put to the Australian government in 2003? And my answer to that question is no. This was perfectly foreseeable and indeed was foreseen. We had the knowledge. We knew what had to be done. It's the political system that has failed to deliver. And I don't think we can walk away from that. Gordon.
Yeah, Gordon Flake with the Perth US Asia Centre at UWA. I think we've been treated to a robust discussion of the future of work from different angles, but it's been largely confined to the developed world. And I'm wondering if this panel would take that discussion and apply it globally, looking particularly at stages of development, because there's a narrative out there that what has benefited, you know, the developed world first, then Japan, Korea, you know, Singapore, and now China, won't necessarily be available to the next generation of countries and phases of development as we move towards a changing nature of work. And I couldn't think of a better panel to kind of help think through that broader kind of global development and how it might play out.
Yeah, okay. So while you're thinking about, and you'll want to take this one, Helen? Helen, yes, please. While the microphone goes over here and then to you, John. Sorry. Helen.
I'll perhaps respond with an anecdote. I was in Laos in recent months and sitting in a conversation with a nascent business body there, and there was a consultant UNDP had brought in to work with Laotian business and government on future economic strategies. And the consultant said to me, I'd much rather be plotting this sort of work in Laos now than in Vietnam. The reason for saying that Vietnam had been one of the countries which had got its growth, its Asian tiger status offshoring manufacturing investment. But with the coming of robots, that wasn't going to be able to be a replicable model for the Laoses and others. So they, in a sense, they weren't sort of hamstrung by having that investment in something that was going out of fashion because of technology, but could, you know, sort of look with a kind of fresh lens on what could be done. But I think there are also implications then for African development,
yeah,
because traditionally we've seen countries industrialise, and then the industrialisation goes offshore, and another wave of countries gets the advantage of getting on that ladder, and that's the East Asian economic miracle, right? But how does that translate to Africa if robots are going to take over production? So what are the employment prospects for Africa? Because traditionally employment's been built up with industrialization, and the nature of that is changing.
Yeah, Pascal.
Yeah, I mean, I broadly agree, and we Europeans start realizing that this is the main African question, and that this African question is our main question for the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken a bit of time, I think, for the continent to realize, but it's coming. But in many ways, it's a very interesting question, but it's a sort of second-rank question as compared to the first-rank question, which is, where are the bottlenecks of African growth today?
Sure.
The problem of Africa today is not robots. The problem of Africa is infrastructures, governance, logistics, energy, grids, agriculture, sort of good old, reasonably well-known issues, which will make the difference between a 4% and a 6%.
Mm-hmm.
I don't totally agree with Hélène that 6% is not enough. Mm-hmm. 6% is the African growth that allows a slight increase of per head GNP. But again, not a first-rank question for the moment. And what we should do is focus much more on financing infrastructures, which is the real bottleneck to African growth, on top of various governance issues, which of course has been there, but it's a sort of chicken and egg issue.
Yeah, okay. Over here, yeah.
Cassandra Goldie from the Australian Council of Social Service. I just want to pick up one of the first comments that was made about how crucial it is at the moment to invest in human capital. And also with the consternation about what is going to be the driver of growth into the future. It seems to me we have got a pretty significant consensus growing that inclusive growth is the framework. What that essentially means is driving, lifting up the living standards of people in the bottom 40% of the population to go against the counter trend. And what we're seeing at the moment, for example, in Australia, which is overall a fairly wealthy country, a counter-approach, which is, with this debate about the universal basic income, instead what we've got is a government policy which is essentially refusing to lift up the basic social protections. The unemployment payment is a really crucial one in our arrangements. When you're talking about digitalisation and the kind of the gig economy and instability of work, we've got a tripling of long-term unemployment since the GFC in Australia, and one job for every 10 people who are trying to find more work. But we've got a counter policy which is saying social security system is the problem, and a lot of policies just announced, more drug testing, cutting people off from income support, as if the fact of the income support system is the problem. So I kind of want to get to the question about, in the international thinking, about the importance of the social protection system and how to prioritise in the government's mind needing to lift up with determination the living standards of people in the bottom 40% to put that at the top of the list rather than seeing that as the cost and the drag on economy.
Mm. I reckon, Pascal, this goes to something you were talking about earlier, the importance of having a welfare system that is has sufficient credibility, that it does not encourage populist, the expression of populist sentiment. That this is your thesis, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I see it, and that's how I explain, basically, differences which have appeared, notably in 2016 and 2017, notably between the continent and UK on the one side and the continent and US on the other side. And we all know that in the US there is a specific problem that an increasing number of white collars are falling into a poverty trap because of the way their system works, or does not work, by the way, including, for instance, on extremely important things like health insurance.
Yeah, okay.
So there is a sort of, cycle of degradation, which their system allows, and which I think it partly the explanation, both on the socioeconomic and on the cultural insecurity, which fuels these populist revendications. And we have to take this seriously. In my country, we are very happy, I'm very happy that, at the end of the day, there was a two-thirds for Macron, one-third for Le Pen. One-third for Le Pen is, in my view, a very high signal that there is a lot of miscontentment around. And, what we've seen last night on the result of the legislative elections confirms that. Not that the president didn't get proper majority, which is a good thing in my view, but still, when you look at the results in detail, you still have very focused, aggressive pieces of miscontentment, and that is something we really need to address. I don't think you have something like that in Australia, as far as I know, but beware.
John Daly.
Thank you. John Daly from Grattan Institute. I wonder if the reason that we're disputing about whether the glass is half full or half empty is because there's a gap between the reality and the rhetoric. The rhetoric is the pace of change has never been faster. The reality is that people are changing industries about as fast as they ever have in the last 30 years. The reality is that unemployment, as various people have pointed out, is relatively low. The reality is that the growth of part-time employment is, if anything, slower now than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. And the list goes on. And indeed, casualisation rates are slightly higher than they were 15 years ago, but only just. And the reason why this matters is that I think that there's a real danger we misdiagnose the problem and so we wind up with the wrong solution. So we say the rise in populism is all about these massive shifts in the labour market. So problem one, there aren't massive shifts in the labour market. And then problem two, who are the people voting for these populist parties? And the answer is actually not the people who are worst off economically. So the people who voted for Trump, the people who voted for Brexit, definitely the people who voted for Hanson and for other minor parties in Australia, are by and large not doing too badly. Indeed, the unemployment rate amongst people who voted for Trump was pretty low. So these are not the... And therefore, the concern is that we say the problem is all about the labour market and inequality. Now, don't get me wrong. There are lots of reasons to worry about inequality. But I would suggest that what's really driving populism is much more about the falling trust in government, and there's also a strong anti-migration element to some of it. And there's a risk that we over-focus on these apparent or supposed changes in the labour market and under focus on the falling trust in government.
Pascal, I don't think you agreed with what you just heard. But look, we're just about out of time. So what I'm going to suggest is this. 1 minute from each of our panellists to wrap this session up, and Pascal, you can lead off.
Going back to this political versus economic / technology cycle, I think we have a serious problem of what Polanyi called at the time disembedding of economics and politics. Now, we have a serious problem about that in some quarters. I don't agree with this diagnosis that, at least on continental Europe, the people who vote for populist movements are mostly poor people. They are not only poor people, but they are mostly poor people. Different with the US, because in the US, the rate of participation of poor people to elections is incredibly low. They just don't vote. They don't expect anything from the system. They just try to survive. So we have this issue. I think it takes different forms in developed countries. It probably will take different forms in emerging countries. And I think we have to put a lot of attention on this re-embedding issue. Depends on political cultures. You can't do it the same way because we don't have the same sort of cultural background. But I think this is a big issue. Again, in relative terms, I think Australia hasn't had to face that seriously in recent times. But it's a vulnerability which I think you should include in your sort of scenarios for the future.
Okay. Helen.
I think in response to the last comment, there's also the issue of perception becoming reality. If you think you're worse off, you'll act accordingly. And of course, a lot of the comment here has been about falling real wages, right? So the perception actually may be correct. But it's also interesting going back to the debate about how disruptive will the fourth industrial revolution be on jobs. And the truth is we don't know. And I will recall, all the debate around, when computer technology first took off, people said, oh, jobs will be destroyed. So we're kind of having that argument again. But we don't know whether this fourth industrial revolution is different in nature from the one we've been through before with technology.
Yeah.
Time will tell, but the only option is to do what Julie stressed, what Philip and others have stressed. You just have to keep investing in people's skills and capacities and education and adaptability for the labour market of the future and hope that it will reach as many as possible.
Yeah. Phil, is your glass still half full?
It is. 3 points. Kind of technology and trade is good for us. That'll drive higher living standards. So we need to find ways of making more of the community benefit from that. And I think you've got to have a decade at least long perspective and it's education and skills to make more of the population feel like they're benefiting from this world which we're going to live in. Mm-hmm. Second point is some pickup in the labour share of national income in many countries would help a lot here. It would make us all feel kind of a bit better. And maybe the tightening of the labour markets that's occurring will deliver that. And that's why I'm kind of slightly in the camp of the half full people. And the third point is that the political process needs to find ways of delivering the type of reforms that we really need. As I said before, there's no shortage of good ideas out there, but in too many areas, those good ideas are not being implemented. And if we can't change that, then we will condemn ourselves to slower growth in our living standards. So the political process needs to find a way of addressing that.
Yeah, okay. And John?
Quickly, I think there's a great opportunity here for the private sector to play the role that must play in order to drive the kind of growth we're talking about. And part of that is the private sector realising the need to re-legitimise itself in the context of the post-global financial crisis. And I think that realisation is taking place when people see the kind of falling trust, not just in government, but also in business as well. And business community, I think, understanding that and is responding to it. But part of that will be a requirement and a reflection on the nature of a corporation post-global financial crisis. And it will probably require a greater emphasis on the public goods created by the private sector and corporations, and there are many. But emphasising those, and in that way, this kind of Milton Friedman-esque view, which is so current, that the only purpose of a corporation is the creation of profit, needs to be understood in the full historical context of a corporation, which was actually created in order to give and deliver the public good, and to do so was given limited liability. So that aspect needs to be reflected upon and re-emerge as part of the positive engagement of business, building trust again in the community and therefore helping drive growth.
Yeah, I think it's a very good place to finish this discussion. Well, of course, this discussion is not finished, but and we've had some pessimists and we've had some optimists in the room, but I have a sense, that if we were able to sit here for another 4 or 5 hours, we'd even get a consensus. And that's So that's an optimistic view for you. I want to thank each of our panellists, and I want to thank you for your participation.